I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to The Connection. The typical kids' menu at a restaurant today offers chicken tenders, cheeseburgers, macaroni and cheese, grilled cheese, pizza, and buttered noodles. That's a far cry from the typical 19th century children's diet when they ate what adults ate, basically anything and everything. Our guest, Helen Zoe Veit, traces the transformation of American children's eating habits over the last 200 years in her new book, Picky. She writes how food technology and beliefs about young people's appetites and taste buds have narrowed their choices, made their food more bland, and paradoxically turned many kids into fussy eaters. Parents of picky eaters are often confused about how to get their children to try new food. Let them eat what they want and they will eventually become an adventurous eater. Or make them try something new, even one little bite, which can turn mealtimes into a frustrating standoff. Helen Zoe Veit is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University and has written about food in the Civil War and the Gilded Age. And Helen Zoe Veit, nice to have you with us today on The Connection. We have a lot to talk about.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me start with you. What kind of eater were you as a kid growing up?
I was pretty omnivorous. So definitely the origin of my interest stems from my own childhood. My parents fed me really diverse foods growing up in the early 1980s. And I also had a really keen sense that the foods that I was eating and liking were really different from those of my friends and classmates. A lot of children of immigrants today talk about the lunchbox moment, a moment when, you know, at a public school often they're opening their lunchboxes and bringing out things that are family foods to them that other, you know, mainstream kids raised on mainstream American children's food think is weird. And I had some of those myself, bringing in, you know, curries or stews to my school that kids thought were gross. And from a very young age, I had a sense that that was interesting. And that's definitely been a through line in my work.
But do you think there's something uniquely about America that has created so many fussy eaters?
Well, today, there are a lot of fussy eaters around the world. Everywhere that this kind of mainstream, highly processed children's food diet has gone, you see childhood pickiness developing, as well as rising rates of childhood obesity, which have exploded by tenfold since the 1970s. However, Americans got there first. Conditions were laid in America in the early 20th century that contributed to American kids getting pickier before anybody else.
Well, let's get to that, but let's go back even further into the 19th century. Describe then for a typical, let's say, middle-class kid at that time, what were they eating?
There was so much diversity. And one of the fascinating things is that I think when people today hear about, like, okay, kids in different time periods or different cultures eat differently, they assume two things. One, they think it must have been harsh discipline. Parents must have forced their miserable kids to eat food they didn't want at every year. It turned out that wasn't true. Parents hardly talked about discipline when it came to food. There was this broad assumption in America that kids were naturally curious, undiscriminating, wanted to eat broad things. The other assumption that we make today about why kids in the past ate broadly, people assume it must have been scarcity. There wasn't enough food to go around, so kids were forcing down vegetables and other hated foods because those were the only alternatives to starvation. And it turns out that that's not true either. What I saw with the research is that a lack of pickiness, kids eating widely, was a cross-class phenomenon. Whether kids were poor, whether they were the wealthiest kids living on Fifth Avenue in New York City, whether they were prosperous farm kids, kids were basically eating what their parents were eating, which meant there was just so much diversity. In the past, Americans ate so many more species of plants and animals than we do today.
But can we say that children came to the meal table hungry because there weren't snacks? They probably were more active than a lot of children today. So literally sitting down to eat meant you were really hungry for whatever was on the plate.
Yes. So this is such a key piece of information. So it wasn't that scarcity was driving kids overall to be non-picky, but hunger played a big role because even kids who had plenty to eat overall, for precisely the reasons you said, they were moving more, doing outdoor chores, walking, and not snacking much, they were coming to meals often just with roaring mealtime appetites. And I always say, if you've ever gone grocery shopping on an empty stomach and you come home with things
in there, done that, yes,
just looked so good, you understand, like, hunger sharpens our ability to take pleasure in food. And that lesson was just being kind of organically applied at dinner tables across the country to kids' benefits. They were learning through hunger and through expectations that they would eat widely, that and through a lack of alternatives. You know, there weren't you know, processed foods in the pantry. There weren't Goldfish crackers. There weren't bananas on the counter. There was no yogurt in the refrigerator because there was no refrigerator. There was not an alternative meal. So kids learned quickly, this is the family meal. They were hungry. They saw kids around them eating it. Everybody assumed they could eat it and like it. And this magic combination really produced generations of happy childhood eaters.
Although going back to the 19th century, childhood mortality was a serious problem. Something like 25% of children died before the age of 10. Now, they didn't all starve to death, and they didn't necessarily die of some foodborne illness. But nonetheless, you know, the thought of losing a child so young in life had got to weigh on so many different families.
Absolutely. So, in fact, the origin of picky eating comes largely from this fear. So as you said, childhood mortality was sky high. Somewhere between a fourth and a fifth of all children died, many of them in infancy, but often later too. The number one cause of death was epidemic diseases, contagious diseases like measles or scarlet fever or typhoid, diphtheria. And we see these reformers in the 19th century. They don't know about germs.
Sure.
They don't know about food poisoning. Food poisoning also killed kids. So, to, you know, why are kids getting sick? Why are they uniquely vulnerable to these diseases? A lot of reformers, before they knew about germs, said it must be their diet. Kids eat so widely. They're so greedy. They'll eat anything. That's a problem. You've got to stop kids from eating so widely. Now, most 19th century parents didn't really listen. They didn't have the luxury of preparing some extra meal for kids. It just wasn't logistically possible. But that general idea just started to reach more people, so that by the early 20th century, you see a lot of middle-class parents starting to take the idea seriously that kids needed special diets.
Let me ask you one more question about the 19th century, and this is about enslaved children. And one of the things that you wrote in this book, and you've written a lot about the Civil War and food, is that enslaved children under the age of something like 9 or 10 were not given food to eat. You even quote from Frederick Douglass, who talked about just being ravenously hungry as a child and the desperation for food. And I just want to make sure we make a notation of that time.
Mm-hmm. So American slavery was a very diverse institution. So practices could vary from household to household, plantation to plantation. In some households, enslaved children were given small rations. But in many others, I was shocked to discover how common it was. It was pretty standard not to give children rations. The idea was they would scrounge and beg. Adult slaves might give them some of their food. They could forage. They could, you know, hunt a little bit or gather plants. But for many enslaved children, there was real malnutrition. Slave owners didn't fully understand the extent to which childhood diet would affect future growth and development. So, you know, it turns out, you know, just from an economic standpoint, you know, there, you see this stunting of slave populations where a lot of enslaved people were really short because of childhood hunger. But yeah, that was one of the more shocking things to me doing the research.
Yeah. And imagining, I mean, obviously living under slavery is one thing. And then, of course, to be desperately hungry had got to be another kind of trauma. I remember reading from some of Frederick Douglass's writing about his childhood, and it's pretty horrifying, obviously.
It's pretty horrifying. Yeah. To add to all the other things that we know about slavery, the routine struggle of childhood hunger, you know, is one that we don't think about a lot.
Going back to the more sort of middle-class American children, you write that the sort of expectation is that, and I think you referenced this earlier, the kids would eat. They would eat what was in front of them. I mean, obviously, there was no choice because there wasn't, as you say, goldfish in the pantry. Mm-hmm. There was no refrigeration. So whatever was on the plate was probably the only thing that was available to eat that day.
Yeah. This is This can be one of the hardest things for American parents today to think about. So I think when you tell parents today, hunger is so important in helping kids to love food, they can get behind the idea, a lot of them, they can conceptualize, like, maybe I shouldn't give my kids so many snacks. Maybe I shouldn't give them so much milk in between meals. You know, that's something I think we can conceptualize pleasant pre-meal hunger as a useful tool. But I do think another lesson from the past is creating a family culture where you don't give alternatives if a child doesn't want to eat the family meal. That's very hard for parents today. They think of that as corporal punishment, as a terrible form of cruelty. Because, of course, they just don't have confidence that children can possibly love these meals. And to me, so much of it gets back to parental confidence. In the past, Americans as a culture, we just had deep confidence that children could learn to love food. And so if a child didn't eat, you know, didn't want to eat something, that just seemed strange to people. And they knew that they could get used to these foods. And it didn't seem at all cruel to them not to provide an alternative food. It just seemed like that was, you know, a consequence of the child's strange decision to reject a family meal. One other thing I thought about a lot while writing this book is that actually parents today, we are confident in all sorts of realms. Hmm. For example, if a child doesn't want to brush their teeth or doesn't want to get in the bath or doesn't want to wear snow boots or doesn't want to wear a seatbelt, we don't think to ourselves, oh, I could never force them to do that. That would be so cruel. It's their body. We just think, hey, I know you can get used to brushing your teeth. I'm gonna brush your teeth today, or I'm getting you into the bath. You need a bath. And because we know, too, soon they're giggling and splashing. Soon they're brushing their teeth themselves. Soon they don't even think about wearing their seatbelt. And sometimes it saves their lives. We're just effortlessly confident in some of these realms. And food used to be in this category, too, where American parents had deep confidence kids could get used to all these different foods. They didn't see it as cruel or strange to say, hey, you're going to join us for this meal. This is the family meal. You're part of the family. That was just the structure of life. And it produced millions of kids who love to eat a broad variety of foods, who grew up to have healthy relationships with food. You know, they did not have dysfunctional relationships. Eating disorders were vanishingly rare. I mean, they were almost non-existent in the 19th century. And things like being overweight or being obese, that was extremely rare too. All of these boogeymen that parents are so scared that they might evoke by pushing food or expecting kids to eat food like them because they've been warned, don't push food, you'll make your kid have a dysfunctional relationship with it. If you tell kids they have to eat a certain amount, they'll never gain a sense of authentic fullness, and then they'll overeat their whole life. So many of these are myths. They just don't stand up to this rigorous scrutiny, which we have when we look to the past.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have to take a very short break, and we'll be right back to our conversation and picking up on some of the things that our guest, Helen Zoe Veit, writes about in her new book. It's called Picky, How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with historian Helen Zoe Veit, author of this new book called Picky. We've been talking about some of the eating habits in the 19th and 20th century for children and how snacks and prepared foods have changed kids' appetites and preferences over the years. Let me just linger a little bit on some of the reformers that you write about, because I do want to get to, I think, today's confusion and frustration about children being picky eaters. You talk about these reformers, obviously before germ theory, sort of throwing darts at a dartboard, trying to figure out why children were dying at such a young age and whether foods had some kind of influence over their health and their future ability to operate, you know, in the world. When did these reformers begin to think that what children were eating was causing these problems?
Some of these ideas had been circulating for centuries. A lot of them are related to actually this ancient Greek theory of the body called the four humors, this humoral theory of medicine that was actually really tenacious. It really influenced Western medicine right up throughout the 19th century. So you have some of these ideas circulating that, you know, children, you know, maybe need special food, that children are naturally hot. People had been wary about things like meat, or strong flavors to children, because those were seen as really stimulating foods. You know, it's what we would see today as pseudoscience, but it was people's explanation for things at the time. You know, what you see is children in the 19th century, on average, eating so many different kinds of foods, oysters, all sorts of different kinds of meats and organ meats, spicy sauces, vinegary pickles, chow chows, relishes, every vegetable under the sun. Fruit was widely considered their favorite food. They loved coffee. They were just eating so much diverse foods. And reformers were saying, you know, this is terrible for their health. This is killing them. You know, literally, we have reformers saying parents are murdering their children through food. This was the argument. Wow. These were the arguments. Now, by the late 19th century, as they start to learn more about germs, that kind of argument fades. And people start talking about kids' stomachs. They start saying, well, okay, so it's not actually causing measles, which they had thought, but clearly strong food must be bad for kids' little delicate stomachs. Kids are smaller, their stomachs are weaker. We still need to protect them.
And that's where you begin to see something called milk toast or wet butter toast. The idea of very bland foods as something that children is good, is healthy for children, and something they will eat.
Yeah. So what was so interesting is if you open up a 19th century cookbook, often at the back, there's a section called invalid cookery. And what invalid means is a sick person. So there was often in 19th century cookbooks a special section on what to cook for people when they're sick. Interestingly, a lot of people were saying, you know, kids could really use the same kind of bland food as sick people. This whole category of foods made by mixing like cracker crumbs or breads or some sort of dried starch with a liquid, whether the liquid was warm milk, sometimes it was wine, but, you know, just these kind of that made this mushy kind of easily eaten foods, kind of almost like baby formula today in a sense, this kind of mushy, you know, like powdery stuff. That was seen as uniquely appropriate for children by these reformers. You know, at the same time, some parents were feeding kids like a really common dish in the 19th century was something called bread and milk. Mm. Again, this is pre-refrigeration. People don't have a way to preserve milk. They don't have a way to, you know, they don't have preservatives in their bread. So, you know, to use up food that would otherwise go sour or stale, a common supper was just like torn up pieces of bread with a little milk on top, maybe a little sugar or a little fruit sprinkled on top. That was a very simple supper that was, you know, pretty common at the time. So there's a lot of overlap with these categories.
When you see food discrimination and the idea that you're very preferential as a child about what you're going to eat, when you begin to see that, and what does it say about the sort of morality of people's appetites, and even looking down on immigrants coming to the country, bringing their food here, and seeing the sort of so-called moral difference between what was served in an immigrant family and what was served in a Native American family.
Yeah, you probably see the high point of that kind of language about like the supposed dangers of immigrant food in the early 20th century. You know, there were millions and millions of immigrants entering the country in, you know, around the turn of the 20th century. Something like a third of all Americans were speaking a language other than English. It was time of incredible diversity. And a lot of native-born, you know, usually white reformers were worried about immigrant food. They still had these older models about how food worked. They saw immigrant food as too stimulating, too, you know, and often weird. But, you know, the things that they thought of as immigrant food were things like spaghetti, you know, like, because there were a lot of Italian immigrants. So, you know, people were like, this paste that the Italians are eating, paste, you know, they're calling it pasta, but it's this weird paste. And they use a lot of garlic and it's terrible, you know, or even things like hamburgers, you know, this was German food, you know, hamburgers, like this wasn't American mainstream food yet at all. So, you know, we see a lot of open prejudice against foods that immigrants were bringing from all over the world, you know, including like Southern and Eastern Europe. Bologna was seen as this weird immigrant food. And children especially are warned not to eat it. See, this kind of garlicky, pungent immigrant food was seen as uniquely dangerous for children's supposedly weak digestions.
It's fascinating that children in the 19th century were drinking coffee as a kind of sort of regular beverage. When did these so-called experts say, you know, children should not be drinking coffee?
The scientist who isolated caffeine in a laboratory was given a Nobel Prize in the early 20th century. I think it was 1903, if I'm recalling. And that really brought caffeine into the spotlight. People had known that coffee was stimulating, that it woke people up, but that had seemed like a virtue for children as well as adults in the 19th century, and children loved it. The idea that children couldn't like coffee, that was, you know, that would have seemed absurd to people because it was so obvious they loved it. But by the early 20th century, you start to see these anti-caffeine warnings, and middle-class parents, and they're the ones who are most likely to hear these warnings, they have higher literacy rates, they're buying child-rearing magazines, so the anti-caffeine messages are reaching middle-class parents and wealthy parents. They stop feeding their kids coffee in the early 20th century. Meanwhile, kids around the country who are, you know, poor, they're children of immigrants, or, you know, they don't have a lot of money, they're still drinking a lot of coffee in the early 20th century. And this is the fascinating thing. They start to do height studies. So by like the 1910s and 1920s, they measure kids who are drinking coffee and kids who aren't. Middle-class kids aren't drinking coffee. They're also taller because they're getting plenty of food. Their families are more prosperous. They measure kids who are drinking coffee, and they're like, oh my God, they're shorter. Of course, they're poorer kids. They're not getting as much food during their childhood growth spurts. It's affecting their growth and development. And a myth is born that coffee stunts growth. It turns out to be totally unfounded. It's not true. Now, too much caffeine is not good for kids, just like it's not good for adults. But still, around the world, especially places like South America, you know, milky coffee is a regular part of kids' diets, and there's no evidence that this is harmful for children. And there's plenty of evidence that children love it.
And how did preservatives, the ability to preserve food? I mean, obviously, canning food had been around for a while, but even the idea of refrigeration. I mean, how did that change children's diets and even their preferences?
Yeah. Drastically. So the flood of processed, shelf-stable food from factories into American homes in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, this does so many things. For one thing, it becomes so easy to offer children alternative meals. So if a 1950s child is starting to be hesitant about a meal, instead of the family saying, well, this is the meal, you got to eat it, all of a sudden they can say, oh, well, we can make you a PB&J. We've got processed white bread in the pantry. We've got peanut butter. We could make you, you could have a bowl of cereal. You could have, we could heat you up a can of soup in 2 minutes. All of these shelf-stable technologies make alternative food, you know, much more possible. At the same time, a lot of these shelf-stable foods are also highly palatable. They've been designed in laboratories to target our biological instincts, to be really sweet or salty, to make us want to eat them. So it's, in some ways, it's changing standards of pleasure. It's also, when parents see kids instantly liking Frosted Flakes or Lucky Charms, or potato chips, it seems obvious that kids can like some foods right away. And then when you're also offering them a spoonful of lima beans at the table, kids might not want to eat that right away. And this idea that they could actually learn to like the lima beans too, that starts to fade from our culture. People see, well, we see them eating this some foods right away. The idea that you would teach children to like food becomes less common. At the same time, psychiatrists and psychologists are starting to tell parents, but especially moms, whatever you do, don't tell your kids what to eat. That's bossy, that's intrusive, that's nagging. That's not good parenting. A good parent is passive around food and lets their children decide what to eat on their own. This was really a perfect storm. The food was more palatable. It was much less healthful. Parents were being warned not to tell their kids what to eat and not to talk about nutrition. And we see kids just gravitate towards this highly processed, highly palatable food.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's historian Helen Zoe Veit, and she's got a brand new book. It's called Picky, How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. You're talking about Dr. Spock. You're talking about, I think, Terry Brazelton. There were other pretty well-known psychologists and child advice people of the 1950s and into the 60s. And I think their goal was really to make the mealtime less of a battle so that you're not forcing your children, that mealtime should be a place where you come together and enjoy each other's company. And yes, you're eating food together, but to fight over getting food into a child's mouth, I think can be counterproductive to a lot of parents and to a lot of children as well.
Absolutely. I don't think fighting over food is good for anybody. The beautiful thing about these older methods of parenting, you know, what we see in the 19th century is there was almost no fighting at all. No one was talking about discipline or forcing kids to eat. In fact, Americans rejected the idea of forcing kids to eat really vehemently. Nobody was talking about that. Of course, parents are diverse. You know, some parents are abusive or tyrannical. So, you know, sure. You could never generalize totally about families in the past. But what you saw happening in like the 30s and the 40s is that there's new attention being paid to nutrition. Vitamins and calories are popular words by this time. There's this idea that children should be eating certain things, that some foods are essential, you know, fruits, vegetables, milk. At the same time, children are less hungry than they've ever been, and there's more processed food. So there had been these battles starting to break out in American homes in the 30s and the 40s, and psychologists step forward, psychologists and psychiatrists in the 40s and 50s, most notably Dr. Spock, who was one of the best-selling authors of the 20th century. He wrote a mega blockbuster best-selling book about childcare that many, many people today will know the name of Dr. Benjamin Spock. And he said to parents, don't tell kids what to eat. You don't need to, he claimed. Children have instincts about what is healthy food. And this was based on experiments done by another pediatrician named Dr. Clara Davis, who showed that in a laboratory setting, if kids are neutrally offered a buffet of unseasoned whole foods, I'm talking about fruits, vegetables, meats, and whole grains that are not seasoned in any way, kids actually, in her experiments, were remarkably good at choosing balanced diets. The problem was that looks nothing like the meal served in actual American homes. In actual American homes, kids aren't getting a buffet of unseasoned whole foods.
Right.
They're getting maybe, you know, one family meal. And when they don't want to eat it, the psychologists are saying, kids have instincts. They must not need those nutrients. Don't force them to eat it. Spock himself said, you know, if a child wants dessert before dinner, give them dessert before dinner. Don't make it a space of anxiety. Ever since, American parents have been so scared to provide the kind of structure that parents used to have in the past because they're worried it will hurt their children psychologically. The great news is that it doesn't have to. This does not have to be a battle of wills. It's not just like if you can only win the war, then your kid won't be picky. There doesn't have to be a war, but we need to rethink from the bottom how we're approaching children's food.
I'm sure many people listening to us can remember sitting at the dinner table, you know, with, let's say, a plate of liver in front of them mm-hmm. and refusing mm-hmm. to eat it and the kind of standoff between the parent mm-hmm. and the child. I remember absolutely despising cooked squash as a kid. And to this day, I can feel nauseous with the memory mm-hmm. of that squash sitting on the plate,
yeah.
being told, well, just one bite, dear, and then you can go out and yeah. play with your friends. And food is such a loaded thing. I mean, it's not like brushing your teeth. It is about this. And for a parent, you want your child to be healthy and survive and live a good life. And so much is loaded into that meal and making sure that your child is healthy and happy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not. It's so complicated because, of course, what can be more intimate than our own personal dislikes and disgust? What can feel more biological, really, than the food that we don't like? The crazy mind experiment is that had any of us been raised in a totally different culture, like if our little baby self had been magically transported to a farm in 19th century America or to a group of hunter-gatherers today somewhere on Earth, we would have totally different tastes and preferences. That's really hard to imagine, but the way that we're parented around food or the choices that were offered or not you know, just shape us in the deepest possible ways. And even things that we think of as so disgusting, you know, liver and onions, you know, that was a real mainstay of a lot of 20th century tables.
Yes,
you know, iron-rich liver was especially recommended for children. And a lot of parents were forcing their kids to eat it. And a lot of parents today, a lot of, you know, people, you know, of that generation today are like, this is an inherently disgusting food. But so much of our likes and dislikes are just shaped by the culture that we're in. And so it's, you know, it's even hard to speak to, you know, sort of like, would you have disliked squash as much if you'd grown up among, you know, in Panama, where, you know, kids were, you know, squash and beans were just like, that was like a basic children's food in the 20th century for kids. Kids were eating snails. Like, you know, it's just, it's hard to imagine. It's so hard to imagine. But like what we see from both history and anthropology is that whatever biological predispositions we might have, and to be clear, I think we do have biological predispositions. I think for some of us, it's much harder to learn to eat than it is for others. And yet we see that in the right circumstances, culture can overcome almost all of those. Mm. That being said, if a child is really struggling to eat, it's vital that a parent seek medical advice, that they, you know, determine, is there some physical cause for, you know, feeding difficulties? Are there aversions? Are there intolerances? Are there allergies? You know, this is really crucial. Where biology gets a lot muddier, however, is in a lot of this really modern talk about sensory sensitivity. You know, a lot of parents today are, you know, very, you know, they think that there are inborn sensitivities to different textures or to different tastes. And what we see with, you know, really just, you know, really clearly from history is that almost all of those can be overcome. You know, and kids can learn to like food that we might think of as totally unlikable, but kids can learn to like them if given lots and lots of positive exposures and practice.
We're almost up on our break here, but I did mention T. Barry Brazelton, again, one of the child psychologists. And he talked about the fact that for a lot of kids, say 2 to 5 or 6, that it's not unusual to be a picky eater, but that over time, you become more adventurous and have less sort of phobias about particular food. And you just sort of have to ride it through that time period without creating a lot of stress and anxiety.
Do I have time to answer that? Or
you actually, you probably don't. So let's take a very short break and then I'll give you a chance to give a full answer. And again, talking about children and eating. And our guest is historian Helen Zoe Veit. And she's got a brand new book. It's titled Picky: How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. And we've been marching from the 19th century into the 20th and now the 21st century, talking about changes in food and refrigeration and how snacks and things have changed children's appetites, what they're willing to eat. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, our guest is historian Helen Zoe Veit. And she's been challenging some of the notions that children are naturally picky eaters. She is an associate professor of history at Michigan State University, author of this new book we've been talking about titled Picky. She's also director of the What America Ate Project and the America in the Kitchen Project. All right, let's just pick up on T. Barry Brazelton. And just in a nutshell, talking about children 2 to 5, basically toddlers, that they have a kind of fear sometimes of something new, but also they're in that stage of autonomy. This is, you know, the period of saying no, not just to food, but to a lot of things that the parents want them to do. Go ahead.
Yeah. So what's fascinating about Brazelton's idea that, you know, children go through this stage of wanting to assert their independence around food, and that is tied with pickiness, contrariness, rejecting what the parents want them to do. That's such a historically specific idea. You know, many that might sound really familiar to us today. A lot of us believe that now. Children go through a stage. It's part of their assertion of independence. You've got to respect their autonomy around food. But that's not only really specific to, you know, the second half of the 20th century and into today, but that's not even what slightly earlier generations of psychiatrists and psychologists were saying. For example, Dr. Spock, who's just a little older than Brazelton, he's about 20 years older. Spock didn't think that pickiness lasted between 2 and 6. Spock thought that pickiness ended by age 2. That's what he writes in his book. He said, by age 2, and this is a quote, children should be eating a pretty grown-up diet. He thought that pickiness peaked at around 18 months and that it lasted, quote, a few months at most. The idea that you could have prolonged pickiness didn't even occur to psychiatrists and psychologists who were writing in the 1940s. That just because they were still surrounded by kids who were generally learning to eat more widely. And they themselves had grown up in the early 20th century when childhood pickiness was virtually non-existent. So even what seems to be this common sense idea of prolonged pickiness and natural rebellion in children that Brazelton and lots of other doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists were saying in the late 20th century, that too is a cultural idea. And just because it sounds commonsensical to us, we should still subject it to the scrutiny of comparison. And we just don't see it happening in other cultures or time periods.
Let me play a couple of commercials because it's interesting to look at this history. The first one is a Kellogg's cereal variety pack. And this is a commercial from 1956. And just to tie it to what you write about in the book, which is the idea of Swanson TV dinners and variety and choice has created some of the things that we have been talking about. Let's hear this commercial. It's just 21 seconds.
Here it is, Kellogg's Variety Pack. 10 individual portions of your favorite Kellogg cereals. Why not let breakfast at your house be on a choose-it-yourself basis, 10 personal portions, each fresh as can be. Delicious, nutritious, convenient. Get it soon, Kellogg's Variety Pack. The world's leading cereal assortment.
I remember those ads, sadly. Yeah, exactly. But it's kind of like treating the home like a restaurant, right? You can eat whatever you want, but go ahead, Helen.
Yeah, so what we see, you know, with the flood of highly processed food and shelf-stable products into American homes in the mid-20th century is this emergence of the idea that family members can and maybe should eat differently from one another, that it is natural and appropriate for everyone to have a pretty elaborate set of personal preferences, and encouraging people to articulate those preferences in relationship to this industrial food system. So the idea that, you know, there are all these different flavors in the supermarket and you might want one and your daughter might want another one and your husband might want something else, that became a really normal way for Americans to approach food. Now, of course, that can be nice in a lot of ways, this sense of variety and choice. But what it's masking is that even as these flavors and varieties are multiplying on the grocery store shelves, Americans are actually eating a much more homogenous diet. They're eating many fewer varieties of plants and animals. And as family eating habits fracture, we see things like shared food and shared meals and the kind of socialization that was just naturally part of that start to corrode in American culture. You know, where, and it's not, by no means is this the only cause of like the decline of family dinner or anything like that. There's so many reasons why that's become challenging for a lot of families. But this idea of personal preferences has definitely been a force that has eaten away at our ability to eat food and share food with each other. And there are all these unquantifiable but really wonderful things that can flow when we share food with people.
But is there something about choice that leads to pickiness? Because I would think if everyone has a choice about what to eat, then there's no pickiness because everyone is happy with what's in front of them.
Yeah, I think undoubtedly. I mean, choice, again, can be wonderful in some ways, but it leads to comparison. It leads to discontent. It can lead to you constantly looking over your shoulder and saying, well, what else is there out there? And of course, food marketers have played precisely into this idea that you constantly want something new. We should have new products all the time. And we're constantly coming up with new colors or flavors, and especially for kids. One of the ideas that emerged in the second half of the 20th century is the idea that kids need novelty to even stay interested in food at all. You know, novelty, but also fun. That, you know, fun became a marketing catchphrase as applied to children's food in the 20th century. And this idea that, you know, food should be interactive, kids should be able to play with it, because otherwise they wouldn't want to eat at all. You know, that's put a lot, you know, of additional pressure on the kinds of foods that we think of as that we can feed to our kids and expect them to like it.
Let me play one more ad. And this is the famous or infamous Mikey ad. This is Mikey's this kid that won't eat anything. And this is actually an award-winning commercial for Life cereal. And it ran from 1972 to 1986, so a long time. Let's give it a listen.
What's this stuff?
Some cereal. It's supposed to be good for you.
I'm not gonna try it.
Let's get Mikey.
Yeah.
He won't eat it. He hates everything.
He likes it. Hey, Mikey.
Regular, cinnamon, and raisin life. Nutritious, delicious.
There's a lot to unpack there, actually.
I love it.
So you've got this picky eater, Mikey, but Mikey's eating Life cereal. So what's the message from this commercial?
So there are a couple messages. One is whatever you do, don't tell a kid that a food is healthy. You know, you hear them say, you hear the brothers say in the ad, it's supposed to be good for you. I'm not going to try it. And when the, another part of this ad that we didn't hear in that clip is there's a voiceover later that says, you know, don't tell the kids it's one of those nutritional cereals you're trying to get them to eat. You know, what they don't know is good for them. You know, I'm not sure if that's an exact quote, but it's the gist is don't tell kids about health because, again, this is this idea from psychology that kids are naturally rebellious. If they think it's good for them, they won't want to eat it. People had never thought that before. People had had complete confidence in children's ability to care about their health and growth. And this idea that, you know, if you tell a kid something's healthy, they're going to hate it. That's been really hobbling for parents. They have this sense like they've got to hide that a food is good for children. You know, there have been some really wonderful movements recently with, I'm thinking particularly of one pediatrician named Dr. Namali Fernando, who started a nonprofit called Dr. Yum. I love that name. And she's working with public schools across the country, and she's really going against some of that. You know, they're teaching kids about the superpowers that different foods have. In other words, these nutrients that help our bodies in specific ways. They're teaching kids to, you know, through multiple positive exposures to smell and eventually taste and cook with and eat different foods. They're having incredible success with this kind of, you know, really straightforward, you know, encouraging kids to eat and telling kids that it's healthy, that this language of reverse psychology discouraged parents from doing for so long. And that really, I think, was harmful for kids and parents alike.
I read that a majority of children in America these days gets their calories from ultra-processed foods. So on the one hand, you see child nutrition at risk. In fact, for a number of, I guess, low-income children, they actually are less tall than their counterparts who live a middle class or much well-off life, that you're seeing some real differences when it comes to nutrition.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, you know, because of both the poor nutrient quality of kids' diets in general, but of course food insecurity and chronic hunger among, you know, poor kids, which is not a small number. I mean, it's something like 1 out of 5 kids, and by some estimates even more, live in homes that experience food insecurity. This is a tragedy. It's a scandal in the wealthiest country in the world. It's completely unnecessary. One other part of this, though, is that even kids in families where there's plenty of food, where food insecurity isn't the issue, we're also seeing malnutrition in some of those kids because of the poor quality of their diets. And Americans' heights in general have been edging downward for a couple of decades. You know, we're now significantly shorter on average than Europeans. And that's, you know, that is in many ways a proxy for the quality of our children's diets.
You have 3 kids, as I understand it.
I do, yeah.
Have you had to deal with a picky eater in your family?
So all of my 3 children were really neophobic when they were young. So neophobic is a fancy word that means scared of new things.
Right.
And they were all, you know, they all resisted new foods all the time. But I was spending my work days with people from the 19th century. I was literally just immersed in this totally different culture of food. So I'd come home in the evenings just bursting with confidence. You know, I called confidence my superpower as a parent. And I created a family culture with my husband, who was, you know, thank goodness, was, you know, incredibly enthusiastic and supportive of this, you know, that in some ways mimicked the structures of earlier time periods, where the family meal was the meal that we were having. I tried to, you know, as much as possible, you know, have the kids have some pleasant pre-meal hunger. I have to say, I'm not totally anti-snack. I think snacks are great, but not right before you're going to eat. And I was a really enthusiastic marketer, I thought of it, for the foods that I like to eat. You know, at the same time, I'm protecting my kids as much as I can from actual marketing. I wasn't at all shy about saying, this food's delicious. It's, you know, these olives are so slippery. This salad is crunchy. These bell peppers have this really interesting taste. I encouraged my kids to eat multiple times throughout the meal. It's not that if I offered something once, I would never offer it again. I offered it multiple times. I never, ever forced my children to eat anything. If they didn't want to eat, I always said, you don't have to eat. You can leave. And this is hard for parents to hear.
I know, but where you're going.
Say you can't have snacks or a dessert if you didn't actually eat dinner. So I'm going to save your dinner in the fridge. If you decide in a little while that you're hungry, I'll just warm it up for you. And if you have two more bites, we'll say you've had dinner and then you can have snacks. My children never once skipped a meal. They always, after a little while, would say, you know, I'm hungry. And I'd say, here, let me warm up the dinner, have a couple bites. It worked beautifully. I mean, it's this all, of course, like this kind of virtuous cycle, the confidence begets success that begets more confidence. I just want parents to get back to that. That is the kind of positive feedback loop that everybody had in the past. This, you know, seeing kids eating widely, knowing they can do it, providing the structure that makes it possible. Now, again, there might be in some cases medical reasons why, you know, children have intolerances or allergies or other medical reasons. But if the main fear is kind of that kids naturally dislike textures and flavors, I can just say that no one ever thought that before. Like, that is a really new idea.
I'm imagining, again, people listening to us and frankly, moms and dads that I know that struggle with this. I mean, whether they're picky eaters or just have very, very powerful likes and dislikes, it can make dinner time and mealtime, with all the best intentions, such a difficult time in a family's life.
It is. I think children's food is probably the hardest thing about parenting for many parents. You know, for others, it might be sleep or it might be social media or something else. But for many parents, food is the worst part of parenting. Mm-hmm. There is so much fear. There's so much anxiety. Parents want to do what's best for their kids, but they have been put in an impossible position. On the one hand, they've been told, whatever you do, don't push healthy foods. Don't tell children they have to eat anything in particular. The kid doesn't want to eat something, just give them something else. Don't even worry about food, because stress itself is harmful for your children. But on the other hand, they're told children's food is important. It's affecting their diets. It's affecting their lives and their quality of life. It's affecting their health. It's affecting their growth. Childhood obesity is rising. Childhood diseases, you know, diseases are showing up in childhood, like type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure, that were never prevalent in childhood before. And parents are they're so worried that whatever they do, they're going to hurt their kid, whether it's physically or psychologically. They feel paralyzed. And then there's all of this new information now about ARFID. It's a new eating disorder, avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. It only was officially entered as an eating disorder in 2012. So it's really new in the scope of human history. That's the blink of an eye. But so many parents are worried about ARFID that the tragic irony is that many of them are so cautious about food that they're doing the very things that in some cases are actually reinforcing pickiness. And I want to get us out of this negative feedback loop and back to this much more positive loop, where there was so much more pleasure for children and so much less stress for parents.
I was reading some of the letters that people wrote in response to the piece that you had in the New York Times, sort of laying out some of the ideas that you were talking about. And I have to say, I was kind of put off by some of the, frankly, judgments and smugness that from parents whose children were not picky eaters, essentially pointing the fingers at those other parents and oftentimes those mothers for creating picky eaters. We have about a minute before we have to say goodbye, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think, empathy with parents. I mean, I've also heard some of these. In fact, the nastiest email that I've gotten, I expected a lot of parents to be mad at me. The nastiest email I've gotten was someone who said I should blame parents more. And wow. I do not blame parents. Mass pickiness is not their fault. It's the product of historical forces. We are all part of the system that has created pickiness. The good news is that when we look to the past, we can see how it was created and we can push back against those forces. But it's going to take confidence. It's going to take some bravery, but it's also going to take love and forgiveness and kindness to ourselves and to each other, because this is a difficult issue for so many people. And I just want parents to know that I see that. I see the pain that they're going through. And I really hope that knowing more about the history can help.
We got to leave it there. Helen, Zoe Veit, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed your book as well. And again, it's titled Picky, How American Children Became the Fussiest Eaters in History. And again, she's Associate Professor of History at Michigan State University. And she is Director of the What America Ate Project and the America in the Kitchen Project. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection as well. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen on the WHYY app. You can follow The Connection on Instagram. And you can find us on Facebook. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, thanks for joining us.